Hello, I'm Simon King and this is Nature Space with Hayes. Today we're on location in Lincolnshire at the home of champion budgie breeder and the president of the Budgerigar Society, Chris Snell. And we're joined by our veterinary advisor, Professor Johnny Cooper, to take a detailed look at keeping birds healthy and promoting good health. It's what I call and will be calling today the art and science of bird keeping. Oh, and we're also joined by around about 250 budgerigars, which you might just be able to hear in the background. So what we'll do is we're going to retire to a quieter room so we can find out more from Chris and John. Thanks for listening.
Well, thank you very much. I'm pleased to be in Lincolnshire. I love being in this county, and I'm very pleased to meet Chris Snell, although I know of him by name and reputation. What I think is lovely is for me, who've been interested in birds, indeed all animals since I was a child, to meet a fellow enthusiast who has championed, in both senses of the word, the budgerigar and keeping of birds and so on. And I must say from the outset, everyone's pulling my leg because I say budgerigar and everyone in Lincolnshire says budgerigar.
Budgerigar.
Fortunately, I do have an interpreter, Mr. Snell here, on a small retainer. Mm. But isn't it right that the name comes from Aboriginal?
Yes, yeah. It came from when the first birds came over, 1840, Professor John Gould.
Yes.
He brought into England, 1840, some budgerigars. And the name budgerigar came from the Aborigine word for becherigar.
Fantastic. So however you pronounce it, or I pronounce it, doesn't really matter because we've stolen it from someone else in any case.
From the Aboriginal word, becherigar, which is good food or good eating.
Right, yes.
And my previous house used to be called becherigar as well.
There we are. And I mentioned earlier its scientific name, and being a vet by training and a naturalist by inclination, its scientific name is Melopsitticus undulatus. Melopsitticus means the melodious parrot, because they talk a bit like you and me, Chris. Mm. They talk much of the time, but it's lovely to hear. And of course, undulatus means undulating flight. So it's a very interesting species. I'm interested in it because it's relatively recent, knowledge of it. When Linnaeus did his famous classification of animals and plants in the 18th century, he didn't know the budgerigar because it didn't actually appear in this country until, early 19th century? You've got some of the names there.
Yeah, 1840. Yes. But when the first birds come over, there was only hen birds.
Is that right?
Because when they caught these birds, in the outback where they go in, the hens will leave the flock.
Yes.
Find the nesting places, and the cock birds will go to them. So when they were catching these birds, they was catching them when the hens were about to find the nests. So they caught 30, 40 birds. And there was all light green or green hens. So they got them back.
That's
and
interesting.
Thinking, well, why won't they pair? Why won't they breed?
And that's the opposite, of course, of our wren in this country, where the male makes various nests and the female comes and inspects them and decides which one she likes. Mm. So there's that historical side. And, of course, I also like to say that Britain played an important part in the recognition of the budgerigar, because before John Gould actually described it, whatever it was, there had been a description by Henry Shaw. Henry Shaw was a fellow of the Linnean Society, which is the society to which Simon King, our compere today, belongs. And he was the first person to realise that it was a new species. So we've got some famous names there and some links with the group that's gathered together. I'd also like to say that the reason why I always welcome meeting someone like you, Chris, is because I'm sure we have a shared belief that animals are good for people, and in this case, birds particularly.
Absolutely, yes.
And some years ago, when I was playing a part as a vet, this is back in the 80s, in promoting the idea that animals had a...
Is this 1980s or 1880s, John?
I have to say I didn't come to Lincolnshire to be so abused and insulted, and I have to say I love your humour. This was the 1980s, and amongst many things I wrote at the time was one paper advocating animals having a place in hospitals and in care homes and so on, because, keeping a budgie, keeping fish, whatever it happened to be, was good for people there. But I also wrote this one, Animals in Schools, and this also mentioned birds as being valuable and young people learning, which I think we'll come on to in a minute. But there's a very nice quotation, I think, at the beginning here, 1713. Alexander Pope said, "I cannot but believe a very good use might be made of the fancy," it's a good word, but he meant fancy, the interest, might be made of the fancy which children have for birds and insects. Mm. So as long ago as that, he was recognising that children in particular respond so well to having animals around and so on. And I expect we'll return to it later on, but I mean, can but I...
You remember, you know, when in the 1960s when I started, everybody had like a hobby, keeping birds,
yes.
mice, rabbits, pigeons.
Yeah.
There used to be pigeon lofts all over Crosby.
Yeah, indeed.
And budgerigars.
Yeah.
And it's something which I'm sure helped my generation to be like we are, and your generation,
yes.
John.
Yeah, yeah.
But now it's extremely difficult to get the younger people involved.
It's so strange, yet at the same time, many of them are aware of biodiversity, the threats to the planet.
Mm.
But my wife is always saying many of these people just see it on television, or they
yes.
see it on their
yes.
on their smartphones. Mm. They don't actually go out and see if they can hear a skylark singing. Mm. They just see it on the screen. Mm. So are you arguing that, in your particular case, budgerigars can be a way of learning about the natural world,
yes,
even though
I
they're kept in
so.
Captivity?
Yes, they're in captivity, but they've got to be well looked after.
Yeah.
And as president of the Budget Society, that's one of my themes of my presidential 2 years, is to the well-being of the birds.
Yes.
I have cages and aviaries and outside aviaries,
mm.
and they are big, because mm. I have this, I believe very strongly that a budgerigar has got to fly.
Yes.
And some budgerigars can't fly because they're too big, and that's
right.
a huge problem.
Yes.
It's a huge problem. And the feathering's gone very coarse, where they're just impossible to reproduce. And my birds have outside aviaries,
yes.
open aviaries, we'll wire them, of course.
Yes, of course.
So they get the sunshine, the vitamins from the sun, and they'll get rainwater as well.
Yes. Well, I'm interested in that because, of course, one of the features of birds mm. is that they are the main class of vertebrate animals that can fly.
Mm.
I know we have
mm.
things like bats and insects mm. and so on, but, I mean, the feature of birds is that they can fly. Their feathers are mm. adapted
yes.
for that. And part of my investigations over many years has been looking at feather problems in birds. And these, for example, I'm just showing Chris here some scanning electron microscope pictures of feathers of birds. You can see this is a barb, mm, and these
yeah.
are the barbules.
Mm.
It's like you
yeah,
know
it's like, yes.
etc. And I was looking for signs of injury, disease, etc. And then some very high-powered ones here, looking to see whether they're actually developing properly.
Mm.
And we know, of course, that quite a number of diseases, problems in budgerigars and other species
mm.
can be related to poor feather development, mm. viruses, etc.,
mm.
etc. But quite apart from that, you've emphasised the importance of flight. Do you think it would be reasonable to say, because there are critics of keeping birds in captivity,
mm-hmm.
aren't there?
There is, yes.
I mean, there are people who are saying, oh, we shouldn't have these in captivity, they should be released, as if you could release budgerigars
well,
back into the wild.
They would all die.
They've changed so much, as
yes,
you're
absolutely,
going to tell
yes.
us a bit later.
Yes.
But flight is so important, and we do know that the wild, the free-living budgerigars in Australia, and I think there are three or four subspecies, but
yes.
they're the same mm. basic one, are in flocks for a start, so that probably tells us that in captivity they either should be in groups, or if it's a single budgie, have the contact with human beings.
Yes.
Would
yes.
you agree
yes,
with that?
Yes.
In other words, they're social animals.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's the first thing. And the other thing is I'm interested in is because they fly, and of course in the wild they have to fly to find their
mm.
food. When there's a drought,
mm.
they
mm.
might go
miles and miles
to look
miles.
For food. Are you suggesting also that therefore they should in captivity be given the opportunity to fly? That's good for them, and also presumably a chance for you to assess their health and so on.
Absolutely, 100%.
Yes.
100%.
Mm.
I go to certain people and they don't have flights, they just have sort of cages.
Mm.
And the birds, because they haven't got the ability to fly 6 feet, they soon become non-flyers. And that's wrong. That's so wrong. We've got to... The reason I keep my birds, they're an extension to my family.
Yes.
I hope my wife can't hear that, because she's upstairs at the moment.
She seems very happy. She's
yes,
very
she's,
kind
she's
to
happy
us.
With it, yes.
yes.
The birds came before her. And, but they well. They must fly. They must fly.
Mm.
And they must be healthy. Because the important thing of any hobby, if it's birds, anything, they've got to reproduce.
Mm.
The future of the species is if they can't reproduce, there won't be a for the bears.
Coming on to reproduction, I'm a bit shy, so I'm leaving reproduction until later. Let's stick to flight for a minute.
I should say, Chris Kiley was one of our first guests and our first episode about keeping budgies, and it's been very well received, very popular. But when we first talked and you said a bird's got to fly, and it to me seemed very obvious, but actually it was interesting to hear you say it's not actually that obvious.
It is obvious, but people can't understand it when I say the bird's got to fly. Mm. Well, they do fly. How much? Well, I don't know.
But can I just say, it's very obvious to me as a vet who has examined lots of live birds, including budgies, and even more, I've done post-mortem examinations on, because I do a lot of diagnostic pathology. When you look at the anatomy, I'm holding up at the moment a sternum, that's a breastbone, of a bird. It's enormous because it comes from a mute swan. In contrast, this little tiny one here, which is still larger than on a budgerigar, but nevertheless small. You can see the same basic shape.
Yes.
And this one actually is interesting. It's got a little twist on it. This is from a small bird here. This is from a mute swan. Mm. Now, I think to myself, why are birds the only vertebrate animals that have this very strange sternum? You and I have a breastbone, but it's made up of several bits, etc. Why and how did this evolve, considering that birds, including the budgerigar, will have come from these ground-living terrestrial reptiles, 200 million years ago, and somehow those evolved into birds. An important part was that this developed, which I'm showing now, with this keel, the sternum, which is, perhaps in a minute you'll say something about condition, and that is there to support the two pectoral muscles, and listeners will be able to hear me scraping where the muscle goes. And so that has evolved, and all 9,000 species of bird, even if they're flightless ones, like ostriches, will still have some form of sternum and to support muscles that would enable them, or certainly would in the past, in the case of some birds, to fly. So you're quite right. I mean, flight is part of the evolution over millions of years of these birds. And if we believe in the five freedoms of keeping animals, one of which is normal behaviour, one of those really should be being able to fly. At mention condition, you're familiar with the musculature over the breast.
Yes.
Why is that important in terms of checking your birds are healthy?
I can pick a bird up.
Yeah.
And I instantly know it's ill because I can feel the breastbone.
Absolutely.
And it's like a
razor.
A razor.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
And the bird might look fine.
Yeah.
But as soon as you pick it up, and it's usually a bit lighter, and what we call it going light
in
the hobby.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and we see it in greenfinches and other birds as well.
It's a normal thing for the early death. And so the muscle's gone.
Yeah.
That's the first thing that goes when you're ill, isn't it?
And it's a reminder to our listeners that birds, like other animals, will mask their symptoms, their clinical signs, won't they? Mm. A bird doesn't want you to know it's unwell.
No,
so,
that's right.
You know, it's only when you handle it, and I do the same. The first thing I do if I have a bird in the hand is feel the keel bone, whether it's a small bird
I do that.
Or an enormous one, you know. But that is part of
the first thing. If I'm, and this is a little, when anybody's purchasing a bird, they should handle it.
Yes, yeah.
People, I put some birds up for sale, they're like them. I said, well, just hold them.
Yeah.
Why? I said, well, make sure it's okay. Because I can't tell. I can tell because I've been doing it 57 years.
Yeah.
I can tell. And I can remember one story, this guy was trying to give me a bird and I refused it. And I didn't like telling him because I thought, the bird was ill.
Yeah.
So, and it would have died within 2 months. But he was trying to give me. And I think, don't buy a bird what's ill.
I'd like to return, though, to a difficult question or subject, and that is of individually kept budgerigars. Mm. Because traditionally, you had a whole spectrum of people, breeders like yourself, professional, who knew all about their birds, the genetics and selection of cock birds and hen birds and so on, and producing these wonderful varieties, which I could list, but you'll catch me out on them undoubtedly. You know, the clear wings and the lace wings and the spangles and all those sort of things.
There's hundreds.
Yeah, exactly.
We've got black faces now, black wings.
But the other end of the scale will be the people who say, well, hang on a sec, I do just keep an individual budgerigar. Mm. And many people have in the past for company. Mm. And I would just like to mention this, a bit of topicality today, because I heard today that, as the listeners will have done, that 1,000 members of the public have had prescribed on the National Health Service their heating bills for the next few months. It was on BBC this morning, it will be on later today. And that is because keeping people warm during the winter is very important for their health. And it made me think of in the 70s, even earlier than my paper in the 80s, when I was working in London, I would work with local authorities visiting people, and my students would go with me, visiting people who lived on their own generally, who were not very well themselves, who were hesitant to keep their little flat, and it was sometimes just a one or two room flat, warm because of the cost. But very, very often these people would have a budgerigar in a cage. And we'd say, but your budgerigar needs the heating. Why don't you keep the room warm for the budgerigar? And as a result, it warmed the person as well. And that rather long-winded story, apart from the link with this National Health announcement this morning, is to say, while the ideal arrangement is what you have here, and I'm looking forward to seeing your aviary, with free flight and that sort of thing, well, let me ask you, is there a place for the singly caged budgerigar?
Yeah.
And under what circumstances?
Yes, I do actually, to family and friends, give babies away.
Yes.
6 weeks old cockbird, which is about the right age. And cockbirds, because they tend to be more...
How do you know it's a cockbird at that age? I can't.
You can. The henbirds will have white nostrils, and the cockbirds...
Now, this is a sign. Now, this vet, I've been a vet for 55 years. I can sex an adult budgie, but not a young one, you see.
It can be difficult. Yeah. It can be difficult sometimes.
Are you sure you're not fooling these people? I mean, you seem such an honest man.
Well, because of sex linkage, I can...
Of course.
No, I can guarantee it's a cop. But I actually let a lady in the 70s, and it was an Australian dominant pied, so she called it Sydney. And she puts it on Facebook, and this budgie, regard, actually knows about 70 words in a year. And it repeats all these words. And I said to when she said, I like a budgie, and I said, I'll let you have one. I went out to the aviary, showed it was still in the box. I said, you can have that one in 2 weeks' time. And I told her to get the cage, cover it at night, put a mirror in so it can talk to itself, and they think they've got two there.
So that's part of the idea of social mixing.
Social mixing.
Yeah,
and
right.
I said, talk to it continually. Start off with, say, pretty boy or his name or Sydney. And then once it said that, you've cracked it. But you've got to talk to it. And this Janice, she talks Butchie all day.
And
it's wonderful for her because she lost her husband.
Yeah. That's wonderful. To me, it's wonderful as well. So there's that advantage. But can I ask you, your birds presumably, they might mimic, but they don't mimic a voice because
they mimic each other.
Right, so they're just doing with this lady. They're doing what they would do with their own species.
They're all minor birds.
Yeah, of course. I used to keep one.
Yeah, and if you had a telephone, certain different noise, it would copy the telephone.
Ours would impersonate the dogs barking.
Yes.
And we think there was someone at the door. We'd all come running downstairs.
And starlings are good for doing that as well. They're related to the minor birds.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you just keep repeating it to it. And it's given this woman... You know, she wasn't lonely by me, but... She got this budgie and she has friends coming around to see it. So it's great for her.
So your message would be, first of all, the birds are good for people.
Yes.
Budgies are good for people. They've been bred in captivity for 200 years. So, I mean, they've been selected, not only for the traits you don't like, I understand.
Yeah.
You'll tell us, I'm sure, about size. But also for, if you like, domesticity, being habituated to humans, this sort of thing. All the valuable things that your own dog here shows, and that's been domesticated much longer. So your message would be, our message would be, nothing wrong with keeping an individual bird,
but
you must remember it's on its own. It hasn't got the company yours have in
Don't ignore it.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Be a best friend.
So, and we would say the same about bigger citizen birds, bigger parrots. I mean, if you've got an African grey or an Amazon or... cockatiel or whatever it is, don't be out all day and just leave it in a cage on its own, because we know what's going to happen. It'll start pulling feathers and things like that.
And also, when he gets an African grey, remember, it's the grandchildren and we'll probably finish up with it.
And it might be bald if it's been pulling its a bit like me, but been pulling its feathers out because it's had no one to talk to. Yeah, so I say that because I'm very conscious, as I expect you must be, of... not just the sort of, if you like, the apathy in terms of keeping animals, keeping birds, keeping your pigeons that you refer to later, but there's actual negativity. You hear more and more people saying or writing, we should not keep birds in cages, etc. And I have to say, and I must keep it anonymous, that quite an eminent British vet has written an extremely good book about animal welfare and what we can do to try and promote animal welfare, how we deal with cattle and horses and everything else. But unfortunately, he has a section on birds, and he comes out very opposed, or sounds very opposed, to birds in cages. And that is based entirely on the fact that he did a study many years ago on zebra finches. And the zebra finches he was studying were ones that were just caged. They came from pet shops. They didn't have the social interaction. And zebra finches, obviously, you know, make that noise. They love it. Absolutely. And they jump, and Chris's. And he didn't experience that. He didn't read the wonderful books by Cyril Rogers and others about zebra finches, nor indeed visit Cyril's aviaries in Suffolk, where he had zebra finches in outside aviaries. And as far as I was concerned, as a sort of, at that stage, middle-aged vet who occasionally gave Cyril some help, those birds lived a very natural life. Yes. So I think it's easy for people nowadays, even this eminent vet, to sort of look at birds under certain circumstances and say, I don't like that. And you and I would say the same about certain things, and to forget that the bigger picture is that, first of all, for some people it's therapeutic to keep a single bird. And, of course, that you can't judge the whole of bird keeping, the whole of aviculture that.
But, you know, generally speaking, the exhibition birds in this country, there's 2,000 members of the Budgie Society, just over 2,000 members. And I don't know anybody who keeps them in bad conditions.
No.
They're cage birds, but to let them out into the outside, they'll die.
Yeah.
So but we do look after them.
Yes, and we are, as Simon has said, we're talking very much about health of birds. I'd like to return to my interest in sort of evolution and anatomy and so on. I brought three preserved feet of birds here. One is an eagle, one is a pheasant, and one is, well, something with webbed feet. I forget what it is. But I brought these along to remind us that birds, much as we love them, are in many respects, forgive me for saying this, glorified reptiles. They've evolved from reptiles. Somehow they developed the ability to maintain their body temperature, so they have a high body temperature. The other thing about a small bird, you hold it in your hand, and you can feel the warmth there, you can feel the heart. The heart is going like a bomb. Absolutely,
because I put it heart to me ear.
Yeah, I know. Absolutely wonderful.
You cannot believe how quick that heartbeat is.
This is a man without a stethoscope, but he probably listens to Budgie's heart better than I do. So I brought these along just to remind us that when you look at the feet of a bird, any species of bird, we see the scalation here, which is a reminder that these did evolve from Africa, actually. Probably a tawny eagle, but they all have that same basic pattern of the scales here, and everything else is made of keratin, the same sort of stuff as we have on our nails and so on. But I wanted to ask you about, in terms of health management, when you go into your aviary, into your bird room, I haven't seen it yet, whatever you have, you're obviously looking at I'm sure as a good bird keeper, you stand back initially and just watch them and listen, and as a good vet should.
And smell as well.
Smell, absolutely. Yes. But what about the feet? I mean, whether they favour one foot or another. Tell me about that.
It's interesting because recently I had a bird where the foot was twice as big and it was all scaly. And I thought, I've got a scaly face.
Which is a mite infestation, Nematocoptes.
And nothing, that didn't do anything. I gave it some ivermectin, and the bird
died.
Which
is an anti-worm parasite.
I was trying to kill the...
Yeah. I'm only translating for the listeners,
And the bird died, but that's the only one I've had.
Can I ask a silly question? You would have checked. It didn't have an elastic band or something around its leg.
No.
Sometimes people miss a thing
you
like that.
You can get the ring on.
I knew you would know that. Yes. But I mean, sometimes with wild birds, people don't look further up the leg and see if perhaps there's a constriction.
That's the first thing I looked at.
Good. Because we've got the right man on this podcast.
I get the rings. If you get any foreign matter underneath the ring. Yeah. Onto the, it can, they can go septic, and you've got to cut the ring. I've got some ring cutters.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the first thing I looked at, but it was the other foot.
So the feet can be an indicator. Yes. I mean, first of all, the symmetry. I mean, we all, I think, when we look at a bird on a perch, are looking to see if the eyes are symmetrical, both each is open to the same extent. If one is slightly drooping, perhaps it's got something in the eye, it might just be a bit of sawdust, or it might be something more serious, whether the wings are being... this is how I do it, but that's as a vet. Tell me if you agree.
Yeah, wings down. The first thing you look at, if it's puffed up a bit, feathers are puffed out, and it's sleeping on 2 feet.
Yes.
For the budgie, it sleeps on one foot.
I did know that because you mentioned it in your podcast.
Oh, did I? Yes.
And does it favour the same foot each time? Do you know that? This would be a good project for a student.
Yeah.
You know, because we know, I worked with the mountain gorillas in Africa, and they favour one side of the mouth over the other when they're chewing their food, and you can recognise.
Well, I suppose we'll have that.
We do.
I chew on the left side.
Is it is it too early to talk about diet? And we're talking about chewing, and we're talking about... And one thing, while I've got you both here, it would be... I'd like to talk about... I don't want to change the subject with you, but I'd like to know about grit.
Can we start on diets generally?
Can I ask you a question? Grit.
Can I just go and look that one up?
No, I think we call it overruled.
Soluble
grit.
Or insoluble grit.
Well, I use the grit from you, Simon.
Yes.
Mineralized
yes.
grit and oyster grit. Oyster shell, I mix it.
Can we explain to listeners who may not keep birds, may not know a lot about them, that grit essentially is in two forms. What I call soluble grit, which would be your oyster shell, where calcium and sometimes other minerals can be absorbed from it in the stomach, and so the bird is getting a nutritional benefit from it. And the insoluble, which is grit that is not broken down or not to any appreciable extent, but remains in the gizzard and helps with the grinding down of food. Yeah. Are you happy with that?
Yes.
Yeah. So you've two sorts of grit.
Yeah, mix them together, yes.
How often do you feed it, or is it there as
the... It's there all the time. We've got some people in our hobby refuse to feed grit.
Yeah.
And I say, well, the grit is an essential for grinding the seed in the gizzard.
They have never looked inside. I hate to keep talking about dead birds, but you can do it with an endoscope. They've never looked inside the stomach of a cetacean bird. There's always grit. In fact, if there isn't grit in there, there's something wrong.
Right.
The lining of the stomach...
That's what I tell them.
Yeah. The stomach of a budgerigar and other cetacean birds is lined with a keratin-like material, like the stuff on the feet there, that's called coiolin, K-O-I-L-I-N. And that is so tough that it can tolerate the grit itself. It provides a firm support for it. Mm. And then when the food goes down, as you know, the grit helps break it up and into smaller parts, which can then be digested properly to get benefit.
This is a really this is an important one for me, because Chris, obviously, when he was very keen to meet you, John, and thanks for inviting us here today. Thank you ever so much. This is a great opportunity for me and for anybody who's listening.
I came for the coffee and the mince pie.
Well, they'd be wonderful.
And it's £30 an hour.
Oh, okay. Well, let's wrap this up with... But Chris, who undersells his scientific ability, understands from the art perspective and how long he's been keeping birds, instinctively knows, or now instinctively knows, after having done this for such a long time, that grit, it's an important part of his feeding regime. But the wonderful thing for Chris to know, because obviously this is really the backbone of, or one of the backbones, is calcium backbone, and so on, of his feeding regime. But John, as a veterinary pathologist, you're now confirming to Chris, because you've been seen inside a bird, that actually he's been doing the right thing. It's the right thing to do.
Absolutely, yes.
Good.
Yep. Any bird, any cetacean bird that hasn't got grit in its stomach, in its gizzard, I'm worried about. There's a problem there. And I think not to feed grit is depriving that bird of one of its natural needs.
So what does that depriving look like in a bird? How would birds suffer if it's not fed grit?
I think we'd say in sort of veterinary scientific terms, it can and often does result in a malabsorption syndrome, because if the food is not broken down properly, malabsorption, M-A-L, badly, absorption, poor absorption of the food.
Right.
So, for example, seed needs to be broken down, I've said that, because otherwise, what I see, if grit is not being fed, is a larger than expected proportion of seeds that have not been properly broken down, and therefore not properly absorbed. the nutrients. Therefore, the food is being wasted. The bird is expending energy on trying to. It produces these enzymes in the intestine to try and break down the various components, the protein and so on, in the food. But if it's not accessible, because the husk has not been penetrated, not been broken down, but if the particles are too large going through the intestines, it's not properly absorbed. Right. If we look at a sample, we can see those down the microscope. And if one did proper studies in a lab and you were weighing and measuring and so on, you would discover that the bird was having to eat more in order to maintain its weight you would expect if there was proper breakdown.
So the bird's not getting the maximum value from the diet, really?
Exactly. You see, some birds don't ingest grit. Birds of prey don't, owls and hawks, but that's because they're taking in bones and the bones serve as grit. If I find grit in the stomach of a hawk, then I think something's wrong. If I don't find grit in the stomach of a budgerigar, I think something is wrong. So you have to know your biology, your natural history. Each bird is, they're very similar in many ways, but each bird is different in terms of its requirements.
Good.
Helpful?
Yes, that's very helpful, yes. Because I've been telling that you should feed grit, but I am not a vet. And they say to me, are you a vet then, Chris? I said, no, but I've read that somewhere. So I'm glad you... confirmed what I've been saying for the last few years.
I'm afraid there are people, including some vets, who go down this path of saying, oh, do birds need grit? It's a good question to ask. It's good for students to investigate and to do some work. But the answer is absolutely, it's necessary to do so.
So in the wild, we've mentioned birds of prey. From a garden bird feeding perspective, garden birds may, I mean, I've seen pictures of pigeons and taking mortar out of, in between the bricks and so on, but also perhaps drinking from a puddle, which would contain natural vitamins and minerals.
And they will land on a drive and ingest little bits of gravel and so on, yes.
Can we talk about a little bit about that? One thing with water here.
Oh, yes.
You do something different.
I'm very fortunate. I live in Lincolnshire, on the edge of the Lincolnshire Wolds. And the old buildings in Forster where I live, they've all got a well in the garden. They've got water coming up.
Right.
So there's a farm next to me, which is... 30-second walk, and they've got water coming out on the... And I take a bucket every 2 days and feed well water, I call it, to the budgies.
Now, tell us why you do that. Is that because you're a sort of traditionalist? Or...
I was just thinking that at first we tried it here, and I made some cups of teas and used it for cooking, and the difference was unbelievable.
Taste the difference yourself.
Oh, unbelievable. Yeah. The best cup of tea I've ever had was with that water. Then I thought, well, hang on, why don't I feed my birds this? Yeah. It's free and it's pure.
Yes.
And there's a guy who works for Murphy's in Nottingham. He's a chemist and he's a budgie breeder. And he came and tested this water. And he said it's as pure as pure.
And has the water come from rain or has it come from under the surface, from soil water?
That's a good question. I don't know.
I only say that.
When it hasn't rained a lot, there's just a trickle.
Yeah.
When it rains a lot, there's a lot more coming out of the pipe.
Because what we're really doing, if we try and analyse that, is comparing water from the tap with water from the well. Water from the tap, of course, has been chlorinated. Well, that'll disappear fairly quickly.
Yes.
It's had fluoride put in it because of teeth, something I should have had when I was young, but I missed that, etc. But very little else. So when you say it's pure water, I don't think any water is really pure, except perhaps in a laboratory. Yes. So that's what we get from the tap water. The water from your well, I would suggest, will have some extra nutrients in the form of minerals. Mm-hmm. Either ones that have come in from surrounding soil, or perhaps being washed into it, or from, is it lined?
It's
the well?
Chalk.
Chalk.
Yes.
Well, it's certainly be getting calcium calcium carbonate from that and a bit of magnesium, etc. So I would argue that there's, again, scientific support for what you're doing because the water from the well, and you said it had been analysed, it certainly appears to be clean and proper, but it has got, albeit only trace amounts, of other things that the birds can benefit from.
So that's pleasing because I started this 2 years ago. I've been here 4 years. And... within 6 months, there was a significant change in my stud of birds. They looked twice as healthy. They was healthy before, but
following
the water.
And what about palatability? Can you tell if one of your birds doesn't like the water? I mean,
No, that's any water they get.
Yeah.
Unless they go into the outside aviaries. They go in the outside aviaries, they would get rainwater.
Yes.
And I feed a lot of chickweed, as you know, that's full of water. And they just demolish that. So
Very interesting, Simon, to encourage some listeners with their bird tables, their bird feeding stations, to try some well water and some water from the tap and see what proportion of birds favour one over the other. I can just imagine a starling trying both because they're greedy birds and then tending to go for whichever one it does. It would be interesting because there's a lot of discussion about how well developed taste and smell are in birds, and we're getting more and more information about olfactory nerves and cells in the buccal cavity and all kinds of things I won't bore you with. But it is very likely that birds are much more discerning about what they're taking in terms of taste and palatability or potability, I suppose, in case of water, than we've realised in the past. It's been very easy to say to people, oh, just fill up water containers and then go and have a cup of coffee, but perhaps we should be doing that with a certain amount of scientific nous as well.
Quite a few budgie breeders will go to Aldi and buy water in bottles.
And what's that got in it? Is it mineralised water?
It's supposed to be pure water. It's supposed to be mineral water. It's just pure water.
Actually be missing out on the things that your birds are getting from the well.
Yeah. Interesting. I mean, this is what I think we've talked about this before. When we collect rainwater for our plants in the garden and so on, you know, my mum does this. You know, she swears by it. Her plants grow better when she puts the rainwater out for her plants. So
there's certain plants. My friend's a horticulturist, and he'll use rainwater for certain plants and tap water for the other plants.
Interesting.
Yes.
Could we move on to food, which obviously Haith is interested in? And that is the question of the quality of the food that you're providing your birds. I mean, presumably, we agree that if they're going to develop decent pectoral muscles for their flight, if their organs are going to develop properly, if they're going to reproduce, produce eggs, produce spermatozoa, whatever, they need good quality food. Yeah. What do you do to check the quality of food that you're feeding? Do you just rely on what you're buying, or do you do any tests? Do you smell it? Do you put it in your hand? What do you do?
Every time I open a bag of seed, I smell it.
Yeah.
And put my hand in.
Right there.
And this is something which Ted Haith, that's the grandfather who died years ago, Ted, but he told me when I was about 12.
This is Raymond Haith's father?
Yes, Raymond Haith's father. Yeah. The original owner, Ted.
Yes, yeah.
And it's to get a bag of seed, take your... like that, pull your sleeve up.
Yeah. Chris is actually pulling his sleeve up right now.
And you put your hand into the seed.
It's wonderful.
Do
this is
that.
A great demonstration.
And he said, if it's dirty, it's surprising. The hand is got some, it's difficult to get, it can go in, but not as easy. But if it's clean, you can go straight in, come out.
Because it sort of slides over your skin, doesn't it? Yes, if it's
and
good
be
quality.
No, if it's dirty, there'll be dust on your arm. And I often do that, and I smell seed as well. I do a lot of smelling in my bedshed.
Well, I do as well, and I teach students, veterinary students. I say, wherever you go, it can be a dairy farm. You just go in there, lift up the the nuts are that they're feeding there, smell it immediately. And I say, smell it as you lift it up, because some of those smells disappear. So this, which I use for teaching, is an example. It actually came from Haith's, of the sort of gunge that their factory is able to remove. I mean, this has been part and parcel of Haith's, hasn't it, for some time, to remove unwanted debris.
John, you've just passed me something really that we would consider the waste product, or after we've put our product through a cleaner several times, really. So there's, when I look at that, I don't see anything in there that's got any value at all. So
except for students, they can learn from it.
well, it's definitely a great example of what a diet might look like if it's not clean.
Yes.
Perfect for students. And you can see all sorts of different things here. You can see some things that won't do any great damage, but they just have no value. So these stalks, these bits of stick and so on, they all have a weight. And, you know, our main beef with those is that, and our customers is, because they get used to buying a product from us that's clean, is it why are they paying for something that has no value for birds?
Because they don't see it at this stage. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And then the next thing is when you look at some of the waste husks, so you've got a black sunflower husk shell there, for example. So if that remains in a mix, then of course it's creating some sort of volume, some weight. But again, it offers nothing for birds. Now, the interesting thing is what we look at, because some of those things are pretty easy to see, it's really what's at the bottom of that bag there. Yeah, so
dust.
Exactly what Chris said, really.
Dust.
Putting your hand, submerging it into seed, and see what your hand looks like when you've taken your hand out. So John's just presenting a very large poster of a presentation that we gave to the British and Irish Association of Zoos and Aquariums, which is entitled Dust is a Dirty Word at Heights Pro. And that's exactly what it is, really. John, several years ago, encouraged us to put our diets under the microscope. And because we asked John whether there was need for quality control of bird diets, and also we used an old strap line from the 1950s, I think, which was "You're safe with Heights."
Safe with Heights, yes.
And John said, "Well, prove it."
Yes.
So we set out on a journey that's taken us several years to basically prove. But again, this small sample here that you've given us, John, that finely ground dust and waste and debris, you can imagine, certainly in the wild, and it'd be interesting to hear what you say about captivity, Chris, but for wild free-living birds, you know, if you were to put that on a bird tape or in a feeder, the birds would naturally sift through that.
Yes.
And that sorting process as they move
through. But not exhibition birds, so they'll be in the dish and it'll be there all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So your members, the Badger Regard Society, would, without exception, buy good quality diets.
Yes.
They'd know where
yes.
they come from, even if they weren't Heaths, they'd be.
Yes,
they'd do the sort of checks
merchants,
that you've talked
you know,
about.
They're all about the same. You know, if they produced a dirty seed, they wouldn't last very long.
No.
I know I'm sat next to Simon, but as my opinion, the best seed in this country is Heaths because they don't clean it, they extra clean it, then clean it again. And that's so important because I don't want my birds eating that sort of dust I've just been looking at.
Yes.
It's got no place in a diet, really, is it?
No,
it shouldn't have.
And also the seed germination percentage, that's important.
Yes. Do you feed sprouted seeds
not? I feed some traditional oats. And
yes.
you don't sell them. You have to go to a big merchant's and they're
yes.
usually dirty. But I've got some clean ones.
Yes.
And I'll soak them for a couple of days.
The bird is then getting the benefit of the green growth.
Yes.
Yes.
That's like 10 times more beneficial
yes,
than
I'm
a
sorry
bird.
To make it so simplistic.
Most nutritional, isn't
yes,
it?
Indeed.
Yes, sprouted
yeah.
seed is
the sort
10
of thing
times
they'd
more
love in Australia and the
yes.
wild.
And that's just one thing I do, but I give, you know, chickweed, sealing grasses, rosemary. I give that the love, that rosemary, and sealing grasses. Chickweed,
and can we
spinach.
Relate that to them in the wild then? I'm just coming back to
yeah.
my biological
mm-hmm.
interest. We've explained that mm-hmm. they came originally and are still found in Australia. Well, they are foraging, presumably, these wild,
yes.
these free-living mm-hmm. Badgerygars. They're in their flocks, mm-hmm. no food here, they're moving on, as indeed do birds
mm-hmm.
here.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're going to encounter different things in Australia from here. Mm-hmm. But your argument is that the more Catholic, the more varied the diet is,
exactly.
the better for
yes.
them. The benefits are what? You're suggesting nutritionally it's good, but presumably the foraging is good also because they're inquisitive birds. They've got these wonderful beaks. I've got a beak of a parrot. In fact, I passed you one. Mm. And the beak is so well adapted for seizing, for
yes.
crushing, etc.
I think, you know, like our diet, say my favourite meal is Lincolnshire sausages. But if I had them every day, I'd be going berserk after a week, wouldn't I? So you've got to vary it.
Yes.
Have a balanced diet. Now, the main diet is a seed. A budgerigar is a seed eater.
Right.
Some people tend to forget that.
Which is why I made the point about the grit and
yes,
the breakdown. Yes,
yes. It is a seed eater. So if you can get the right seed, the right balance of seed, then the balanced diet, you're nearly there.
Yes.
Everything else is the little bits.
Like what about choice? I mean, do your birds...
They have a choice of loads of seeds.
So you'll have the odd bird that prefers this to that,
it's
as
amazing.
You do on a bird table with wild birds.
You
I mean, individuals vary and
yes.
species do. Yes.
Generally, it's 50% canary seed. And most of them, my birds, most of them, I would think 99% eat canary seed. Because it's got a little bit higher vitamin in it than the other millets. Not much.
And they can seize it easily.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they... And if I go and top up the seed dish in a cage, they'll always come down and eat probably five seeds, which is a very small percentage. Then they'll think, I've eaten what I want, I'll go back for something else later. But they'll go pick
yes.
out different seeds.
Yes.
And every bit's different, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I don't know how many seeds, there might be 20 seeds in
yes.
it.
So you're offering variety.
Variety all the time.
Yes.
All the time.
Yes.
And I do think a bird will actually pick out what it wants. Every bird
yes.
is very individual. It might eat some oily seed, like the Japanese millet.
Yes.
So, and linseed, they'll eat that because winter's coming and they want to build a bit more muscle and fat into the diet. So a bird is doing naturally what they do in the wild.
So we see that in the wild. Obviously, you know, when we put higher calorie diets out, and also you'll see that selection of the higher oil. So do you think then, for your birds, that we talked our first episode or episode one, we talked about daylight and how that affects things in the buddha. So do you think that your budgerigars somehow know that it's, well, they'll know about the temperature because the temperature changes.
It's nature. I work with nature. I don't work against it.
Which is very important. Looking at a living bird,
yes,
it's part of nature.
Yes.
It's evolved over millions of years. It's having to adapt to a very rapidly changing environment. So you're looking at what is natural. Yeah, I think that's very important.
Really, and that I think resonated. We've had a few comments from people who listen to that podcast, and certainly the daylight and the lengths that you go to provide enrichment as well. I think that's the other thing. You know, we might all have our favourite foods, Lincoln's sausage and so on, but actually if you ate that every night,
and it'd be probably...
You'll look like me.
Yeah, you'd probably...
And can I also say, we were just returning to flight and to feathers, I'm interested in the effect that poor nutrition has on feathers. I mean,
absolutely.
Plenty of feather abnormalities, and obviously as a vet I'm interested in these viruses and mites and so on. But I mean, for example, these are some very badly formed bantam feathers that I've used for my teaching.
Can you explain why they're badly formed, John?
They're badly formed because they haven't erupted properly from the feather follicle. This is what we call pinching off at the base here. You can see the white area there. The feather has come out, but it's still enclosed, and so as it emerges, as it goes up from there, it is essentially compressed by the base here, so the feather just doesn't develop properly from then on. So that's there. This one has got, you can't see them very well in the light here, and I'd have to use a lens, which I have, but I won't, this can't be seen, I won't produce it, but there are fault marks in the barbs, and that's the sort of thing that we've got here. This again is low power electron microscopy, but you can see some very nicely formed barbules there, but they're still not interlocking properly, and on this side there are gaps. So
is that a lack of vitamin?
It can be a lack of almost anything, or an infection, but I mean common things are common, and a lack of something is most likely. And one sees that in wild birds, if it's a very wet spring, for example, and there's parent birds can't get enough food for them, or one parent dies and the little nestlings are not getting the proper diet, either too little food generally or specific deficiencies. So when you
can I ask you a question then, John?
Yeah, I don't promise right answer.
If you had 200 budgies
and
you had 10% with that problem, what would you feed them or what would you do?
I would first of all change the diet for a small group of them. Don't change everything at once, and never change things too quickly, as we both know. And see if a different diet, whether it's just a different seed diet or perhaps a seed diet supplemented, as you say, with chickweed or whatever, for some of them made a difference. The trouble with feather abnormalities, as you know, is because birds molt essentially once a year, tell me if I'm wrong over budgies, but most do, then you've got to wait to see the effects. So anything I study in feathers is really looking at things from a few months ago. You know, it's a bit like your hair going grey. Mine's naturally grey because I'm old, but people who suffer from sort of shell shock, the greyness takes time to come out, and that's very much the same. In that case, the hair follicle has contracted, or the blood supply has been reduced, and that's why the hair comes out a different colour.
If, I mean, just going on that arbitrary, say, I don't know, 10% of bird, what in the wild would that feather formation or that lack of formation still be a thing in the wild?
So it would be a death sentence, probably.
Yes, really.
I mean, survival of the fittest.
That's it. Yes. That's what we've got to do in our hobby. People are breeding these birds and they're going to die. So why breed? You know, you don't want to be reproducing birds once you're sick. They'll reproduce sick birds.
So you're saying that in exhibitions, you've got to be a bit like a farmer. You've got to be ruthless. You're still humane.
Proactive.
You don't want, and therefore, if birds are not going to survive or thrive, you do something. If necessary, they have to be culled, which, you know, one doesn't like to say, particularly talking to the public, but this is a fact of life. It's It's survival of the fittest, and in this case, survival in captivity. And I think it's important, if we're going to promote captive birds, to say those birds should be of the highest quality and at the highest welfare standards. And welfare standards are not met if a bird has feathers that aren't functioning, feet that are knobbly, got this problem or that problem or whatever.
Okay, let's have one look at the birds.
Right, so as you can probably hear, we're in the bird room right now. This may not work, and whoever's listening to this may struggle a little bit, but I think it would be a shame to come all the way out to Lincolnshire, John. Obviously, I'm being invited here by Chris, who is, as Chris said, is the president of the Budgerigar Society and also a champion budgie breeder, to not have a little tour of his wonderful bird room. Can we just start, Chris? Would you mind telling us how many birds are in here to start with, please?
I don't know. I would think about 250.
So this is what, if you've ever wondered what 250 budgerigars sound like, this is it. John, what's your first thoughts, John, in here?
Well, the first thought is it's super to be here with living birds, and I'm enjoying it, and also how much already I've learned from Chris about the breeding programme here, etc. Behind me is an open area, an open aviary, which if there wasn't avian influenza about, I'm told that birds would be out in a flight.
Yes.
And behind you, Simon, holding the microphone, are breeding cages, is that correct, then, with nest boxes? And Chris has been telling me about pairing up and so on. The art of breeding budgerigars is here in the chap on my right. I'm learning a lot in this bird room.
Yeah. And me too. The first thing that strikes me is how much air there is flowing through, how light it is. Is that, we talked before about daylight.
Well, first of all, I've got louver windows at the end of this bird shed. It's 35 feet. Sorry, things not in metric. 35 feet to 15 feet. So I have the louver windows for ventilation, and I have an extractor fan that comes on about three times a day for an hour. So and big windows, obviously the louver windows will get natural lighting.
You know, the other thing we talked about, dust, and how important it is to remove the dust from seed before it gets into a bird's diet. But it strikes me also, in this environment, you know, you just don't want dust in the seed, not just for birds' health, but for your health,
well,
too.
The dust in this bird shed is feather dust. Mm. It's from the feathers, not from the seed.
Mm.
It is a problem. Really annoying.
You don't have bird sanctuary lung or one of these terrible conditions.
No.
Obviously not. I mean, I should say for the listeners that most people don't develop these problems, and of course you can get it working with horses or any other species. But good ventilation, as you say, Simon, is vital for the health of birds and very, very important for humans as well.
Mm. But, you know, you mentioned also about the birds, and I think I've been here before, Chris, and noticed the birds have been in the outdoor aviary. So your budgerigars are all indoors now, are they?
Well, there's bird flu about 4 or 5 miles from here. As a president of Woodcliffe Society, I've got to lead by example. I believe Jeffers told me that budgerigars cannot carry the bear flu. But I said, I will lock my birds in, and they said, thank you.
Yes. I think that's what the law says, because they're captive birds. But we do believe that you could have covered aviaries here, but the wire mesh would have to be of a certain size. I don't know those specifications, but the Ministry, AFA or DEFRA could tell you. But I think if in doubt, it's best to keep them in.
Yes, yes.
I mean, this like my own county of Norfolk, is an avian influenza county. And I mean, the whole country is under restrictions, but Lincolnshire and Norfolk have so many domestic poultry that need to be protected, and indeed are keeling over and dying from this condition.
So what intrigues you the most, John, when you come in here and take a look around? What's the first thing that comes to mind?
Well, I've been in many bird rooms over decades, so it doesn't come as a surprise what I see. I'm delighted to be here because it's just fun to be back doing these things after COVID and so on, or the COVID lockdown. I think the thing that impresses me when I come in is the amount of space. The room that we're in here has, 3 or 4 metres of space, of this corridor, if you like, in the middle here, where equipment can be stored and so on. So birds are not cheap by jowl. The breeding birds are sufficiently far away from the the mixed ones here to keep them, to a certain extent, isolated. I just like the atmosphere. I like animals, I like birds, and I like people. I like the person I'm with today.
Well, it's funny you should say that. But even though there are so many budgerigars, and I think anybody listening will know it's not quiet, I actually feel quite relaxed in here.
Yes.
It's a relaxing environment.
Fantastic.
So give him a job to do.
Yeah. You could clean the floor for me.
Well, I don't know if I'm that relaxed. But I have to say, it's not... I've been in here a few times and it never is what I'd expect. There's always plenty of room, as John's already explained. It always feels that there's fresh air moving through the bird room. And I do feel... It's actually quite enjoyable to be in here. It feels very lively.
Yeah, and could I say how educational this would be for a young person in particular who's perhaps never come this close to a number of birds like this? Are you able to bring people in?
Yes, I have 80 visits.
You do?
I have 50 people in here.
Yeah, and are these people who are already committed to
They have different societies throughout the country.
Yes, yeah.
They'll come on a Sunday. They do two visits. They'll probably go somewhere. Well, they'll come here first. We'll go down to a local pub for lunch, and they'll go somewhere else in the afternoon. And
sounds very good. Yeah.
And some stop overnight.
Yeah.
Some stop overnight. Not here.
Oh, that's very nice of you to invite us, Chris.
The pub sounds good as well, doesn't it?
So we've talked a lot about bird health, and we started to talk about how keeping birds can be good for our health. How does it make you feel, Chris? I mean, you've been keeping budgerigars again for how long? Sorry.
57 years.
So how does it make you feel when you walk it?
Just like being at home.
You're relaxed.
Yeah. I'm totally relaxed. Yeah.
But you look very happy. I mean, that's the thing.
I love being in here. Yes. I've been here this morning doing things, and there's always something to do. And my wife says to me, I'll come in sort of 10 minutes' time. So the dinner will be 1 hour. Because she knows I'm lying, it's not 10 minutes, it's 60 minutes. And she'll say, you haven't been doing anything. And said, because I think doing nothing in your bird aviary is when you start to look at the birds and look for anything, what's going wrong, and new pairings. That's just as important as actually cleaning out, feeding, doing the manual work.
Yeah.
To look at your birds. To see,
listening,
smelling,
etc. Yes, all those things.
And
yes.
Looking at new pairings, and because I can look at my birds and I know what the parents are, surely in my head. Mm. And I can know the grandparents, and I know the faults and the good points. So I'll see another bird and I can see their grandparents and parents.
But do you keep records as well?
Yes, I keep records.
So can I just say, John, is this music, as a veterinary pathologist, is this music to your ears?
Oh, absolutely, yes. It's wonderful. I'm only a veterinary pathologist because I'm interested in finding out why birds and other animals sometimes are unwell or die. I prefer them alive. And if they're in the hands of someone who cares for them, they will remain alive for an extended period of time.
Chris Snell, John Cooper, just want to thank you on behalf of Hapes. Thank you for inviting us here, Chris.
Yeah, it's been great. It's been really, really interesting.
We'll be bringing the professor back. Is that okay?
He can come back anytime he wants.
And John Cooper, everything okay? Have you enjoyed that?
I loved it. And the chance actually to see Chris's birds and to talk in practical terms, and of course to learn from him has been marvellous. Thank you very much for arranging it.
You're very welcome. This is Nature Space with Hayes. Thank you.
Thank you.